Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Further from sobriety. So sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety.
And now it's time for Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art, with your hosts, Leslie M. Scott Jones and Clinton Johnston. Now, here's Clinton and Leslie.
Well, good morning, Clinton.
Good morning, Leslie.
How are you?
I am well. How are you?
You know, I'm tired as... Wait a minute, I can't say that. We'd have to beep it.
You cannot say that.
Yeah, I can't say that. I can't say what I want to say. I'm a little sleepy. I had an incredibly long day yesterday that started out with running after like 40 children from the ages of 7 months to maybe 7 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the start of my day. Yesterday.
That's a heck of a start right there.
It was a heck of a start. Yeah. So, yeah, so I'm a little pooped.
And how did you find yourself doing that? Why did you find yourself doing that?
I was at the Kid Zone at Albemarle Square ACAC.
Mhm.
Yeah. So, all those little children.
Why?
All the little children. because they pay me. That's why. Because they pay me. Yeah.
Oh, the day job.
The multiple day job of artists.
Oh, the hideous, right? Horrible blight of the day job.
Right. So we can have enough food in our bellies to entertain you people.
I see you day job looming like a cancer over us.
I know. No, it wasn't a cancer. I mean, they were all lovely and whatever. It's just, but 40 of them, it was just, you know.
That's a lot.
It's very loud in there for a moment. It was just, you know.
I can dig that.
Yeah, so that's how my day started. 5 hours of that.
Do you know it's also lovely and wonderful?
You?
No, our first guest.
Oh, okay. You were going there.
Yes.
You were doing that segue. Okay, you were doing that segue. I get it. I'm here now.
We should have her on the phone. Rashida Bumbre, you there, Rashida?
Yes, I am.
Oh, awesome. Can you hear us?
I can hear you, yes.
Excellent. And we can hear... All right, yes. So let's see. So welcome to Homegrown, your show about local art. You're calling us all the way from New York City. Thank you for taking your...
Yes, I am. I'm in the heart of... I'm in Penn Station, so I'm in, like, a quintessential New York City...
Oh, great.
Right now,
well, all right. In the middle of Penn Station. Awesome.
That's good because the view is so important on radio. We like that for establishing the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So, Rashida, you are a choreographer and a curator, and you're going to be performing at UVA's Holmes Theater on February 1st. Your piece, yes. Run, Mary, Run. So can you tell everybody what that's about?
Absolutely. So Run, Mary, Run is actually using the structure of a traditional ring shout, which is really, I would say, one of the New World African forms, which is sort of a universal Africanism that was carried over. So it's a dance and a song, and really essentially the dancers are shuffling their feet and moving in a counterclockwise circle. Our call and response songs, which are spirituals, the rhythm of the ring shout and the sort of driver of it is a stick, because it was developed during a time when drums were actually banned for fear of revolt and, you know,
right,
after the Haitian Revolution, for example. So it was really the way that Africans from many different contexts, which landed in the Sea Islands, South Carolina, Georgia, you know, as a result of the slave trade, were actually able to communicate and actually able to have a moment of healing, a moment of levity, given the, you know, really deafening and, you know, I guess the opposite of life-affirming, crushing realities of white supremacy under slavery, and then also during Jim Crow and the ring shout still exists today, actually, through a troop called the McIntosh County Shouters, who we reference a lot through our tonal vocabulary and the songs that we use.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that we sort of change it is really to bring contemporary music. So we bring Parliament Funkadelic, we bring hip-hop, Mos Def, into the song structure, really as a way to connect this continuum, this lineage of Black music, which originates in these early forms like the ring shout.
Okay, I'm kind of freaking out right now. Parliament Funkadelic with traditional African dance. I so wish I was going to be in town to see this now.
Well, I think you should be, if it's possible.
Unfortunately, I will be traveling, but this is, this sounds absolutely amazing. So how did you create this piece? What was the impetus for, especially combining contemporary music with traditional dance?
Well, you know, when I was in college, I went to school in Ohio, Oberlin College. I had two instrumental teachers, one Adenike Sharpley, my dance teacher, who spoke about the ring shout a lot, and who will actually be performing with us in Charlottesville, as well as Wendell Logan, who is now an ancestor, but he was the head of the jazz department, and I used to work in his office organizing VHS tapes. If you can imagine
a time when we used VHS tapes. Yeah,
exactly. And he said, oh, you're a dancer. You need to know about the ring shout. And he had me watch these videos. And as I watched them, I realized, like, I kind of already knew this, but I didn't understand why I knew it. I didn't understand why these songs felt so natural to me, why these rhythms were kind of like already embedded in my consciousness. And as I started to work on them in my dance class and in performance, I realized that it's because all of the music that I listen to has this element, has this root.
Right.
And so it was really something that the line sort of connected to me. And at that moment in the 90s is when Dr. Dre was using Swing Down Sweet Chariot in hip hop.
Yes.
And so, you know, it became clear, like, oh, the spirituals are showing up in Parliament Funkadelic, they're showing up in hip hop. So for me, it was just like making a continuum between this music that I was learning but already felt like I knew, and then the music that I listened to every day, which, you know, all sort of was already connected. It was really me just sort of pulling it out and allowing people to hear it in one space.
So have you ever gotten any pushback from people about, like, traditionalists who think that these dances should only be mirrored with traditional music? Have you ever gotten someone to say, well, you know, you're like disrespecting the art form or anything like that?
You know, I haven't. And the thing that has been most sort of incredible for me is having elders and actually someone from the McIntosh County Shouters say, like, this is the first time I've seen this done this way, and it's amazing. And I think it's really because the main sort of goal for me is to give contemporary people, contemporary Black people specifically, access to what is already ours.
Right.
And so I think, you know, it's really about what do we need in this moment, specifically this political moment. We need the forms that were created in the moment that was quite similar to this for our own healing specifically. And so I think the intention is really about what were these forms created for, why were they created, and then how can we resurrect them and have access to them now in a moment when we actually are in a very similar positionality in terms of, you know, state-sanctioned violence, murder of Black children, you know, in broad daylight on camera, obviously the realities of the prison industrial complex. All of these things are very connected to this same legacy of slavery, where this music and this dance was created. And so I think that it was created so that we would have access to it, not so that it would live only in an archive somewhere.
Right. So I think I know the answer to this question, but why UVA? Why bring this particular piece to UVA?
Well, firstly, my grandmother is from Charlottesville.
Really?
She, as a teenager, yes. As a teenager, she moved to Harlem, where my mother and all of her seven siblings were born and raised. But my mother, the first time she went to Charlottesville was actually for her grandmother's funeral. And so my great-grandmother would tell them stories about Charlottesville. It's like literally in my DNA, but also we had a family reunion there where I actually went to like our family burial ground, which is like at a church there. And so we have, I have a direct connection. And then obviously when everything happened, with, you know, white supremacists taking to the street,
right,
and actually, you know, I think our moment, our this country having a moment of reckoning around what is always present, but what is being revealed through Trump and through this moment, this political moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when Paloma asked me if I would do this, I said yes without even knowing how I would, you know, like if
yes,
any, you know, everything would like be lined up, because I knew that I needed to do it. And also because I know that this is not who Charlottesville is. I know that because of my own family. I know that because of the mayor that you just elected.
Yes.
And so I think, you know, it's really important to affirm like who we actually are, in the face of this kind of, ugliness and hate and, you know, ahistorical kind of framing.
So is this going to be part of a larger, presentation at the Helms Theater on the 1st, or is this only going to be Run, Mary, Run?
It'll only be Run, Mary, Run, but we will have a panel discussion afterwards. And, you know, we'll have some community leaders in that conversation. And as I understand it, this is part of a lot of conversations that have been happening since this summer.
Yes.
So we're kind of, you know, plugging into that, and also we will have a discussion afterwards, because we understand the necessity of not just having something happen and then like walking away and
yes,
not having a space for people to actually digest what the experience was.
So do you know who is going to be on the panel after the performance?
I wish I did. I'm sorry that Paloma McGregor from Dancing While Black, who really is the curator of this, and is organizing that aspect of it, I'm sorry that she's not here. But yeah, I think maybe what I could do is send that to you and you could announce it a little later in the show, because we do know who it is. I just don't know
right
off the top of my head.
No, that's fine. So we only have a couple. I know we only have you for a couple of more minutes. So my last question to you is, what exactly is a choreographer curator?
Well, it's really just two strains of who I am, that live in the same body. So I'm a contemporary art curator. I've worked in museums. I've worked at performance spaces. And so I traditionally make space for other artists, as, you know, in my career. So I've curated exhibitions. I've curated performances. And I also am a choreographer. So I make dance work. And I think that my sort of participant witness style comes from being in both of those positionalities. So the mm-hmm. fact that I am always aware of the necessity and the need for other artists, I think is why I actually make work in collaboration. So you'll see that it's a large ensemble. There are 10 people performing. And part of that is really just because that's how I work. You know, I grew up in a dancing school where there was really, you know, I learned everything I knew in community.
Right.
And so that's how I make my work. So it's really just that I'm both a curator and a choreographer. And I think I'm starting to now reconcile the two in my performance work, which is largely could be called a social practice
mm-hmm.
endeavor, because it's about community. It's about, you know, working in context, and also, you know, combining multiple people's legacies, multiple people's, the residue of who they are into the work. So, yes.
Well, that's amazing, Rashida. Thank you so much for joining us this morning and letting us know.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, the performance sounds amazing, and I want everybody to go see it. February 1st at UVA Helms Theater. Run, Mary, run. Thank you so much, Rashida.
Thank you. Have a great rest of the show. I'm so honored to have been here.
Oh, no. We were honored by your presence. Thank you.
And I look forward to being in Charlottesville very soon.
Yay.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow. That's a lot. Like, wow. Just wow. Like, to take African dance out of... that grew out of, wow, trials and tribulations and all that, and combine it with Parliament Funkadelic? That's awesome.
Oh, is that what she's saying? I wasn't listening.
Clinton! Clinton!
What? I tuned out in New York.
Really? Really? You just heard Penn Station, and you're like, oh, that was too many people, I can't.
Is actually, she had a position, what was it, positionality?
Oh.
When is that? Because that's the second time I've run into that word recently. When did that become a word?
You have a thing about words, don't you?
Well, you know, I like to actually speak. Yeah.
Wow.
No, seriously, but is that something like what's how is?
I don't know. Somebody Google that for Clinton really quickly. No, someone Google that for Clinton really quickly, and you know, see if Funk and Wagnalls have actually made it a word. But you don't like Funk and Wagnalls anymore because
I prefer Parliament Funk and Wagnalls.
No, you don't like Funk and Wagnalls anymore because they changed the definition of literally.
Oh my gosh. Not their fault. But such an evil thing. Such an evil thing. It's not just, no, to be honest, to
okay.
be fair.
Okay.
It's not just the change of the definition of literary. It's the addition of its opposite.
Yes.
It's just... I understand language is a flowing river. It develops, but that is a sharp and bitter eddy to that river. It is a sharp
but
and
no,
bitter.
Seriously, folks, y'all should have been in the room when that happened.
Figuratively, yeah, like, flowing river.
I know.
Not literally.
Oh my God. Yeah, y'all should have been in the room when that happened because he was so mad. There was like a 15-minute like rant.
Talk about tear the roof off the sucker.
Oh, yes. He was about to. He was about to. Are we going to do our list?
Do you want to do the list now? I think we should go right to the next guest.
Oh, okay. We can go right to the next guest. I am fine with that.
And we'll take
because
actually, you know what we should do.
What? Should we pay a bill? We should pay a bill. You know, just one. Just one, though.
Just one.
Just one.
Oh, you're not gonna do the David thing?
No, I'm not gonna do the David thing. My voice is tender. He gets all loud and everything. I'm not doing that. No. Okay. No.
Probably, yeah. 19 minutes past the hour, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art. I'm here with the wonderful and fabulous Leslie M. Scott Jones. What up, Les?
Not much, man.
All right.
Not much. Just, you know.
It's a low-key morning.
I'm trying to get through Sunday morning. It's really early. I was up until like 2 a.m.
That day job took you down.
And now it's like rainy and
day
all
job
gray.
Took you down.
Those children.
Those children.
They run and like have energy. And
jump and skip.
Oh,
and
my God.
Have flights of
you know,
fancy
and then they
and
come,
misuse literally.
Well, no, and then they come up to you. Hold me. Hold me, which is like it's like playing peekaboo. It's a game that never ends, you know. It's like okay, but you can't stay glued to my hip for like 4 hours. Like at some point, you do have to like get down and like have a life.
It sounds like it sounds like working with the medicine ball, except without being able to throw it away.
Clinton, no, we would never throw the children.
I know, that's what I'm saying. It's half the exercise of a medicine ball, because somebody throws you a medicine ball, and then you catch it, and then you throw and you catch it. So this is just you just holding it.
It's just holding it,
You're just holding it.
Actually, there was this lovely little, I think she was like three, this lovely little girl, Aubrielle is what was her name. And she would just go from person to person, just hold me.
Oh,
hold me. And I'm like behind the desk, like checking people in. So she, hold me. And so I pick her up and she literally like presses the side of her face against the side of my face and just kind of like held it there for like 7 minutes. She was like, this is comfortable. And I'm like, okay, I'm glad it's comfortable for you. Not so comfortable for me, but you know, I'll grin and bear it. It's all right. Sweetie.
It's like, it's okay. Honey, if you're getting this tired now, the next 80 years,
I know, right?
I'm not going to be good.
Brittle spirit. That's what Dave Chappelle called it, a brittle spirit.
Let's head over to our next guest we have here in the Homegrown Studios from a little known theater. Every once in a while, I hear about this theater.
Every once in a while.
Every once in a while.
Yeah, every once in a while, it pops up.
A whisper.
Yeah.
A slight hint on the wind.
A wafting, if you
a
will.
A wafting. A wafted theater. Live Arts Theater downtown. We've got with us...
We've got the entire cast and the director of Top Girls. That's awesome.
Oh, my gosh. Claire Chandler, Gretchen York, Jess Christensen, and Betsy Tucker.
Woo-hoo! Woo!
How are you guys doing this morning?
Are you going to be okay? There's a lot of estrogen in this room. Are you going to be all right? I'm just asking.
Oh no, I shall faint like a wounded testosterone lily.
Hey, I'm just asking.
How shall I ever get by?
You don't mind being the thorn among all these roses?
That's an image right there.
Right? That's an image, right?
That was good.
That was good. Every once in a while, I get him. All right. So Top Girls.
Yes. For our audience who may not know, somebody tell us what Top Girls is about. Passing it off.
Up to you.
All right. Yeah. So Top Girls is a British play written in 1982. And it deals a lot with women and success. How do they become successful? What do they have to give up to become successful? Mm-hmm. And it takes sort of a look at Thatcherism versus a sort of British socialist feminism stance. Mm-hmm. And they sort of duke it out, and which wins.
So how much is this play a comment on Thatcher? And does it comment on Thatcher enough do you think our audience can get something of it without having an extensive knowledge of the wonder and horrors that was Margaret Thatcher?
Most definitely.
That was Reagan's girlfriend.
Right, exactly. Churchill was... she wrote the play.
This is Carol Churchill,
the author, the playwright, wrote the play after visiting and interviewing Americans. So, yeah, you'll be able to get it.
Wow. So she
the mic.
Hold on. She visited Americans and just interviewed them about what they thought about.
She was here for some symposium on playwriting in New York City, uh-huh, and ended up fascinated by Americans and their consumerism.
Well, yeah, we do have that, don't we? So then that gave her the impetus to write the play. That's so cool. Wow, at least we did something.
Yes, we did.
I guess I think one of the things that makes the play particularly relevant for today is it does sort of gesture towards contemporary feminism in that it's asking the question of what does... not just what does it take to be successful, and the ways that we in some ways still privilege aggressiveness and self-interest and de-emphasize things like nurturing or those are questions that have led to, I think, contemporary, you know, feminism. And so I think we can all understand those questions, even if we don't understand Thatcherism, mm-hmm, specifically, or that sort of,
I suggested that we do this play right after Trump was elected. I actually had thought of it earlier. I thought it would be a really interesting play. Maybe it was before that. I thought it would be a really interesting play to do if Hillary Clinton was president. because she's definitely a top girl, and she definitely has a lot of the aggression that was exhibited in some of these women in the play. But it's also equally interesting now that Trump and his golden toilet are elected, because it's pretty much where we are right now. The high flying culture economic scene in the early 80s in Britain and America kind of parallels what's going on right here. And so it's a good time to ask some questions about who's left behind, who's not part of the program.
So is that something that, Betsy, as a director, you like to do, like ask those probing questions against society?
Yes, I like political plays. I like political plays, and I like feminist plays. So this is pretty much the
So this
twin.
Is your time period.
Right. Yeah, right.
This is the era that calls to you.
That's right.
Awesome.
It's great. It's great. How is it? So the play deals with specific characters, specifically famous women in history who have been in charge, who have been at the top. How has it been dealing with these characters?
I guess it's been for me. I'm Gretchen. I play Pope Joan, and so the Pope is the woman who you know, reached the highest, you know, most authoritative position. And for me personally, it's been both this mix of real connection and alienation from this character. I expected to go in and totally understand this character. She is a woman who essentially gave up her femininity in order to pursue intellectual ambitions. I'm an academic in real life, and I'm very familiar with being really excited about really esoteric things. And I expected to completely identify with her, and then I had to realize that I was very different from her in that I wasn't used to. I've had to figure out what it means to be treated like a man, or what it would be like to inhabit that space, and that was so different. So I feel in the same ways that many of these characters are trying to connect with one another, but feel very disconnected. That sense of real intense connection and I guess I use the word alienation, and I'll say that was the best the sort of my experience of the character.
Mm-hmm. Jess.
Yeah. Jess.
Yes.
So we play musical microphones.
My first character is actually a literary character. Her name is Griselda, and she's actually more popularly known as Patient Griselda. She has the adjective patient attached to her name. Mm-hmm. She's been written about by multiple authors, and she is multiple male authors, and she is known for her obedience in this wonderful marriage that she's led. And so it does highlight that there is strength and patience and understanding with people, but it also is really hard to inhabit that space of finding the strength in obeying everything that has been told to you and telling this story in a way that keeping this character's femininity and obeying the man in her life somehow made her famous. And where does the strength lie in that? Is that actually a weak thing to do? And what does that look like in modern terms? Because, I mean, it's been very hard to get into the understanding headspace of knowing why this was a good choice for my character. Yeah. So I do think I'm one of the characters in Act One who kind of hung on to traditional concepts of femininity, and I just did air quotes. You can't see that.
Yes, but that's okay. It's the magic of air quotes, is you can sort of feel the air
them.
Quotes.
Yeah, yeah.
And, if you believe in the air quotes enough, if we all.
But the femininity is kind of something that also alienates her from a lot of the other women at the dinner, at the table, the other historical women, that, you know, she was the perfect princess, and she fainted in a dramatic situation, and how dare she hang on to those qualities? So there's a lot there.
Claire?
I play Marlene, who invites all these historical women to the first act dinner party in a sort of surreal first act. And you have to kind of wonder why she invites these historical women. Does she have no friends? And that's kind of what I've been thinking, because Marlene is a tough cookie. She has thrown away any nurturing feminine side to compete in this, in the job market that, mm-hmm. that she's in this employment agency. She has done everything that she can to get ahead. She's left her family behind. She's left her past behind, poor working class roots, and has fully adopted Thatcherism. Anyone can do anything if they've got what it takes, the personal grit, and if they don't, screw them. That hasn't been difficult at all for me to...
Which is sort of the flip side of that Reagan-era 80s pull yourself up by your own bootstraps.
And yeah. She's been kind of hard to take on.
So how important is the male gaze in each of these characters? I mean, obviously, Griselda, it's very important. but how does that impact the other characters?
And no male characters in the show, right?
No.
Right. Well, it impacts in different ways, I would say. Lady Nijo, who's a courtesan, a Japanese historical figure, 13th century courtesan, is very affected by the male gaze. She is, like patient Griselda, a princess in her own way and has very rigid codes of behavior that she follows for at least half her life until she abandons them and becomes a nun and walks throughout Japan. Strange choice, but, I mean, interesting choice, challenging choice. Although, as she says, what other choice did I have at that point once the court rejects her? Isabella Bird, who's the 19th historical, 19th century adventuress, although she dressed always as a woman, occasionally she wore various forms of Eastern trousers, but she dressed as a woman and apparently ridiculed the press when they tried to describe her as anything other than feminine. But she lassoed cattle and lived with a man in Colorado, for heaven's sakes. She went to China. She went to Australia. She traveled around the world. She climbed mountains in Tibet. She was all over the place in her later years, at 50. She got married at 50. I mean, she's a wild, crazy Victorian adventuress, so she didn't really care too much about the male. It didn't seem to impact her very much. She was not a beautiful woman. She never had that as a calling card. It didn't seem to bother her very much. She liked being active, not intellectual. A lot of these characters like activity. That's another thing. They like adventure. Marlene likes adventure. Isabella likes adventure. They want to get out. They want to get out of the world that traps them, I guess, and have adventures. Who else? We have Gret, who is painted by Bruegel, and she storms hell. So she's not very interested in the male gaze. On the other hand, the second act of the play, which takes place in 1980 in an office, is full of women who are projecting 1980s power women. So they are projecting a kind of aggressive female thing that's flashy. And what is, Marlene says later, there are lots of men who like to be seen with a high-flying lady.
Shows they've got something really good in their pants.
Right. So they realize they have a commodity and it has some value on the market. Mm-hmm. Even their aggressiveness has value on the market. And there are different responses to this. It's really not a play where men are talked about a lot, interestingly enough. They're just not often the subject of conversation. I mean, they are occasionally, but it's much more about other things that women talk about, how they live their lives.
I feel if the male gaze is really present in the play, one of the places, just to go back to something that you'd said earlier about, you know, what other choice did I have? It's in the way that sort of masculine expectations shaped the choices that the characters make for their lives. But then they go on and live their lives. And that's also part of what the play is doing, and not having the characters always talking about men or always about their relationships with men is, okay, so this is the limited universe we live in. What do we make of that? And that's one of the sort of really, I think, inspiring things about the show, even as it's critiquing.
Well, but that's also something that, you know, women have had to do from since the beginning of time. Like, oh, okay, this is my situation. Don't really like it. But let's, okay, here we go. Let's do it. You know, that's kind of been a woman's lot in life, for lack of a better word.
Shall we do the rundown of what's coming to take a break from our conversation and come back to it?
Sure. Let's do that.
All right.
All right. Currently running February 23rd, local artist Aaron Aycrist exhibit at the Back Room at Second Street Gallery. Also through the 27th, Tuesdays from 6 p.m. to 8:15, join instructor Jane Friedman for Social Media Labs for Writers, crafting a strategy and a presence that fit you and your writing career. That's not actually what's written on the paper, but I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be fit. Offered by the Charlottesville Writer House, but meeting at Indoor Biotechnologies. Currently running through March 8th, Tuesdays from 1 to 3:30. Join instructor Kristen Rembold as she looks at pattern and form in poetry at the Charlottesville Writer House. Through April 8th, the Actors Renaissance Season at the American Shakespeare Center presents Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, Congreve's The Way of the World, John Marston's Antonio's Revenge, and Hamlet and Richard II by Shakespeare, all at the Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton. February 2nd is First Fridays. Woo! Art openings on and around the downtown mall. Check out the exhibit by painter Giselle Gautreau. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Giselle. If not, I'm so sorry. Opening at the Charlottesville Writer House, February 3rd and 4th, Father-Daughter Valentine Dance. Oh, my God. At the Charlottesville Ballet Studio Theater. That's going to be precious. Is Sean doing that?
No, yeah. He has done it, but Maeve refuses to do it again.
That's awesome. She's like, no, I'm not dancing with you anymore. February 3rd, free guided tour of the Kluge Roo Aboriginal Art Collection, the world's only museum exclusively dedicated to Indigenous Australian art. Also on the 3rd, Brad Stoller and Mecca Burns introduce you to the games and exercises that explore issues of power and privilege in the Theater of the Oppressed workshop at the V. Earl Dickinson Building at Piedmont Virginia Community College. That sounds really cool, and Brad and Mecca are very cool people. Y'all should go. February 9th and 10th, romantic duets plus newly commissioned works by the Charlottesville Ballet at their studio theater. The 9th through the 11th, a view from some broads at Four County Players. And for your musical options this week.
Today, Zuzu's Hot 5 gives you a Mardi Gras brunch at Fellini's at noon. Also, singer-songwriter Renee Ruth trots out her new groove dance band at Waldorf Brewery at 2 p.m. Kelly Garrett and Gary Green at Glasshouse Winery also at 2. Travis Elliott and Tucker Rogers at Star Hill Brewery at 3:30. And still going on for today, a lot of stuff for today. The Ravenna String Quartet plays 2 Beethoven Masterworks at Old Cabell Hall at 3:30 p.m. Our friends Help Me Helen plays James River Brewery at 4 p.m. And there's the acoustic open mic at the Space Lab at 5 p.m. January 31st, Maddie Metcalf puts down his accordion and sits down at the piano at Fellini's. Also on the 31st, improvised funk band Functional Electric plays at Rapture. February 1st, Charlottesville Classical Guitar Concert Series continues with Milan Pareshnikov at The Haven. And I'm sure that I didn't pronounce that correctly. It was with such confidence, but not correct. I think I added an N.
So we basically have to apologize to two artists today.
Milan Pareshnikov, that's it. Pareshnikov. February 1st, the Michael Ellswick Gathering and Nick and Steve Pollock at Fellini's. The new hardcore duo Time Nothing at the Anteroom. February 2nd, Full Tones to the Max at Dirty Nelly's, Faster Than Walking at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub, Bob Bonetta, and then the Chickenhead Blues Band at Fellini's.
Woo!
February the 3rd, High Rock Energy Trio Bobblehead plays the Batesville Market, and, oh, one of my favorite band names, Johnny B and the Goods at the Star Hill Brewery, and the Ragnarockers at Wild Wolf Brewery. It's a double up on good band
names. I love that name!
The Ragnarockers on Wild Wolf Brewery. Eli Cook and the band. What up, Eli?
Hey,
Dirty
Eli.
Nellies. New Boss and the Sorority Boy and Soju Blue at the Southern Cafe Music Hall all playing together on the February 3rd. And Luca Dora at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub and John Dirth at Friends at Fellini's. Every Friday morning, of course, it's the West African Drum Circle at the Front Porch Roots Music School. Every Monday, the Bluegrass Jam at the Front Porch Roots Music School. Also every Monday, it's Seafoot, the Charlottesville Friends of Old Time Music, their weekly open jam at the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Unitarian Church. Where
Ooh.
Else? Every Monday is a singer-songwriter night at the local. Every Tuesday, the traditional Irish session at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. Every Tuesday, Latin Guitar Night with Miles Pierce and Humberto Sales at the Bebedero.
Bebedero.
And every Wednesday, the open mic night at Pro Renata Farm Brewery. Bam! The open mic night at Holly Deli's and Pub hosted by Josh Mayo. Bam! Jazz Collective Number 9 at Fellini's Number 9. Bam! Bachata Fusion at the Anteroom presented by the Charlottesville Salsa Club. Bam! DG and Friends at the Bebedero. Bam! And the Mike Rosensky and Jeff Decker Quartet at Miller's.
Ooh.
Ooh.
That's a long list for Wednesdays, man.
Man, Wednesday is your day. And if you haven't tired yourself out Wednesday, every Thursday, Lua at the Bebedero. And of course,
every Thursday, John Dirth
John
at
Dirth.
Miller's.
Down at Miller's, because every once in a while, you just got to come down to Dirth. And those are just some of the artistic options in our wonderful
can I just
artistic
say,
town. You can say. Say it.
David Tewksbury is playing at Fellini's tonight at 6.
What?
It's a solo. Yeah, it's a solo deal. Yeah. Y'all should go.
What up, David?
Because he's awesome. Love you, David, and I will be there.
Feline that sucker, David. Feline that sucker. 22 minutes past the hour. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Stay tuned after the show, won't you? For the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with your host, Rick Moore. Their guest today is UVA Associate Professor of Politics, Todd Sexer, talking about U.S. relations with North Korea.
You know, I bet he gets his name mispronounced a lot.
I bet he does.
Probably in some very interesting ways, too.
But probably one hopes by very interesting people.
Right?
Because, you know.
That's a conversation starter, right?
If someone's going to mispronounce your name, you would hope it would be somebody interesting.
Okay, I can't go where I want to go because it's radio. I can't go where I want to go.
Were you going to say something that FCC chairman and Verizon cheerleader Ajit Pai was going to say something?
Yeah, he would have nailed us for that one. I can't. I absolutely can't. We should go back to our guests.
I'll
just be over here collecting myself.
So this is Homegrown, your show about local art. 44 minutes past the hour, we're sitting here with cast and director, Top Girls, coming up at Live Arts, Gretchen York, Jess Christensen, Claire Chandler, and of course, Betsy Tucker. Hey, guys.
Hey.
So it's interesting, when I asked you before what your experience was playing with these characters, you're looking at something. Oh, okay. You're just. Leslie's
Thanks.
Looking at something.
I'm looking at the Facebook Live. Thank you, Lorenzo, for the shout out. Love you too, baby.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, Lorenzo. It's interesting that none of you talked about the difference in playing these characters as opposed to playing other characters that you blame me. And maybe you're fortunate. How many of you have been stuck playing, like, the girlfriend? Or stuck playing, like, underwritten characters? The ingenue,
this
right?
This is American theater. Yeah, we've all been stuck playing that.
I mean, one would think that this is a cavalcade of rich characters for you to really dig your teeth into.
Oh, most definitely, yes. The language, as Betsy often says, writes itself. 2-year-old could act it. It's just fantastic playwriting, and the characters are are rich and multi-layered.
Now, speaking of language, frequently with English playwrights, at least to me, I can hear them writing in English, as opposed to American English, and to my ear, there can be some awkwardness if you don't hit it with the appropriate accent. And even some English playwrights, they're picking which English accents for which characters. Is there any of that going on here? And
is there any language work? Dialect.
Oh my goodness.
Yes! Multiple dialects.
Yes! Most of us are doing two or three.
Because live arts brings the noise. That's why.
Yep.
Yes. We've been working with a fabulous dialect coach, Tova Close, and she has really helped us hone the geographic dialects within Britain and also outside of. I mean, Gretchen is doing a fusion accent of German and English, right? Like a British German accent. And so we have that. We have estuary, we have standard British, Irish, Italian, a whole bunch of stuff.
Wow.
Scottish. So oh, yeah.
So how fun/hard is that?
It's fun and hard. But similar to the characters being really, really well written, it's hard because the writing is so good. The accents are hard because you want to portray these characters truthfully, exactly, and you want them to be real people and not caricatures. Of course, our historical figures, they are the theatrical representation of these real people, right. But we still want them to be human, and that is hard and awesome.
So, by the way, your husband's watching. Wave hello.
So, Betsy, the parts of the play that are set in the 80s, are you leaving them in the 80s? Are you doing anything to?
Oh no, we're 80s. We're there. We got the shoulder pads. We got the shine. We got the heels. We got the stockings.
All right.
Yeah. Not everybody's flashy, but Great costumes. A lot of costumes. I mean, seven actors. I think 16 characters.
Good. Wow. Gracious.
Three. You know, multiple time periods. So we have historical period costumes, a variety of them, and then we have 1980s working world and 1980s. Small town, Britain. So
Betsy, you're familiar with Churchill. You've done Churchill stuff before.
I've actually directed this play before.
I was about to ask, because I thought so.
Right.
What's it like
20
coming,
years ago.
What's it like coming back
ago.
To it?
It's, it's fine. It's a long time ago. I had forgotten a great deal of it. I actually ran across a production photo this weekend from the first production, I went, oh my God, I need that prop. Why didn't I think of that prop? That prop was in my, I thought of it the first time. How could I have been so silly not to have thought of it this time? It's going to be added this week. I actually have the VHS tape of that show, as well as
I'm surprised you still have the prop.
No, I don't. Okay. But I have to recreate that prop. I also have a cassette of the music we used for that first show, and there's a lot of music in the show. We're using both rock music by women from the 80s, so we got Cyndi Lauper and Madonna and Pat Benatar and like that.
Joan Jett?
I think so.
Yes.
And then we've got contemporary women artists, so we're using contemporary music, and there's going to be quite a lot of music in this show that's going to drive the second act particularly. And I've worked, it's really a great soundtrack. We have a great music, our music director, our sound director is just terrific. She's a DJ too, and she just knows everything. So we have a great playlist, and it's going to be, actually, somebody recently said, oh yeah, you directed that. It was a musical, right? What they remembered was the music from that production. So it's going to be fun to listen to the music. If nothing else, the music will drive it home.
You're going to sell CDs?
Oh,
That would be.
You should sell CDs. Okay. Seriously, if your soundtrack is that good, you should sell CDs.
Except that would be a violation of copyright.
Yes.
Maybe we can add people to our Spotify playlist.
There you go. Mr. Wet Blanket over here trying to like dampen all of our fun over here.
Excuse me if I don't want to get live art.
That's
sued.
What I'm saying. I want the playlist. That's what I'm saying. And I'm sure other women would too. So what's it like playing multiple people in the same show? Like what's that switch like from one person to the other, and how much time do you normally have to make that switch?
I'm playing three characters.
Dun dun.
Between the first switch happens over intermission, and the second switch happens over a 15-20 minute scene. And so I do have a bit of downtime. It is crazy how much hair and costume actually do contribute to stepping into another character. So that physical transition does help with the mental emotional transition. Also the dialects help. I have three different dialects that I'm doing for those three characters. But other than that, it's just been a lot of working with Betsy and our assistant director Kelly on, making specific intentional traits, choices for what's going on in each of the characters. Who are they? Where are they in their life? Are they in this office for the very first time? Have they been here for years? Have they been here for years, but they're still the youngest one there? Questions like that, kind of trying to position them within their situation. That is something that has really helped me find my multiple characters.
Yeah, and in as much as I think, for me at least, keeping the accents separate has been hugely helpful, and also one of the pitfalls of doing that, you know, is that the two accents sometimes start to bleed together. So there's a lot of practicing backstage, okay, someone talk to me because I just need to do this standard British for a little while. And that. But yes, it's costumes and hair and makeup, the heels. You know, in the 1980s, really help a lot with, I'm going to sort of walk, you know, this way and with this confidence, and, you know, I'm going to sit on the table and sashay a little bit. We were talking about lob-on effort shapes, and Jess is the one who's really good and about talking about that. But even that, is my character's predominant motion a flick, or is it a sort of... dab is another term, or, you know, what are their modes of speaking, and sort of being able to categorize those has been helpful in differentiating the two as well.
It's interesting that you say that. Have you guys seen the commercials for whatever this Masterworks, Masterclass, mm-hmm. this Masterclass, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. insane. They're getting all of these insane people to do like these classes, and I just saw I've seen a commercial for Helen Mirren. Have you seen for Helen Mirren's Masterclass, where she's talks about the, you know, very briefly in the course, the power of a costume. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you're talking, you know, work with your costume designer. There's this one moment where she's standing in front of a dress and this dress in a bad wig, Oscar nomination. I'm like, whoa. Okay, Helen, say it.
In a bad wig. That's awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. Well, and I've heard similar things about object work, something that I've particularly, a few mentors of mine have talked about, Meryl Streep's object work, mm-hmm. where she will get a piece of jewelry or a prop that is important to the character that she's portraying, and will work with it on and off set and put meaning into it, and right. that kind of thing. I mean, the costume carries that too, for sure. The shoes are so important. We got our shoes early in the process, and thank goodness, because it is the first piece. You get to ground yourself through those characters' shoes. And that is, the earlier it can come, the better, because you get to literally walk, walk in their shoes.
See, now you've ruined Meryl Streep for me, because now I'm going to be obsessed watching whenever I see a Streep. It's like, what is it? Is that her? Is that her object?
Is
that her?
That's it.
I'm going to have to go back and relook at the post. It's like, is it the phone? Is it the necklace? She plays with the necklace a lot. What is it? It's got to be something. Done. All right. Well.
Wow.
You guys have rehearsals to get to.
You do.
And work to do today. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Could you give us the what, where, when, and why before we take off?
Yes. The show opens February 2nd. Friday, February. That's coming up. And runs through the 24th. Call the box office at Live Arts. And we have two special nights we're calling Top Nights, February 16th and 23rd, when we're going to have pre-show hors d'oeuvres. And we're hoping to gather an audience predominantly of women. As Ray says, you don't have to be a woman, but it helps. and we're going to talk about some of the issues in the play. It's going to be a kind of social gathering to talk before the show about some of the issues in the play with the production staff. And we actually may get Claire parading around there in her evening dress, too. That might be pretty fun. it just occurred to me. I think that might be a good idea. That's it. Come and see it. We
only
have some
champagne.
You have to buy your own drinks. I'm sorry. We have several matinees and some early shows, and Wednesdays are always pay what you can. But we've already sold out 5 shows, so don't wait.
Get to that box office now. Top Girls at Live Arts, Gretchen York, Jess Christensen, Claire Chandler, and, of course, Betsy Tucker. Thank you guys so much for coming on Homegrown.
Thank you for having us.
Have good shows. Have a good rehearsal.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC. The progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Homegrown, your show about local art. Wow.
I know. Okay.
So both fun and games.
I think I have to say something, and people are probably going to hate me, but you know what? I don't care. I have had like several conversations this week about this whole Aziz Ansari thing.
Yeah.
I've had several conversations, and every single one of them has gotten me to a level of passivity that I just can't comprehend. And the reason is that I think the problem with this is that everyone I have talked to has discounted the fact that there were two people in that room responsible for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not saying he did anything absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
Mm.
Not at all.
Mm.
However,
mm.
there was a woman in that room who had the responsibility to, number one, know her boundaries, and number two, speak them clearly. And both of them failed. Both of them failed. And I don't think it's fair to blame one of them for everything.
I'm just waiting until we can start calling Aziz, I'm sorry.
Because he's been having to say it like over and over and over again. When he did not, like, really? I mean, yeah, I'm just... All right, so they're going to be like freaky phone calls. Jeff, get ready for like death threats or whatever. I'm sure, whatever. But I don't care.
It's Leslie with her mini rant here on Homegrown, sneaking one in right at the very end.
I had to do it, people. I had to.
Stay tuned for what's coming up. We'd like to thank this Homegrown, your show about local art. We'd like to thank our guests, Rashida Bumbray. And of course, Betsy Tucker, Gretchen York, Jess Christensen, and Claire Chandler. Any complaints about Homegrown should be directed to our attorneys at the fine firm of Tochterman, Overman, Munson, and Burke. Legal services like a song. Coming up next is Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Your host, Rick Moore. Their guest is UVA Associate Professor of Politics, Todd Sexer, talking about U.S. relations with North Korea. Drink every time they say the word nuclear. 2 drinks if they say nuclear. This is Homegrown.
You've been listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.